It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And we are starting Halloween a bit late. That seems to be the common refrain for this show. This episode was technically reserved for September, which is why you're going to hear a lot of references to the month that's already passed. But due to issues behind the scenes, it's coming out now. And thankfully, it still fits the Halloween theme. Woo! I don't have good ghost sound effects, so you're stuck listening to me. But in honor of our centennial star of the month, Teresa Wright, back in September, we're going to kickstart October by having Drea Clark and I talk about Alfred Hitchcock's 1943 drama, Shadow of a Doubt.
Do you know the world is a foul sty? Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine?
I don't want you to touch my mother. So go away, I'm warning you. Go away or I'll kill you myself. Your hands! Oh, let me go, Uncle Charlie! Let me go!
To many people who knew her, Teresa Wright was a sweet, sensitive, down-to-earth person. Utterly unaffected by Hollywood, this beguiling sense of normalcy situated her as the perfect embodiment of the girl next door. And with a career spanning 56 years and nearly 90 titles, Teresa Wright is often forgotten because of how meek and mild her characters were. But that's not to say that she's forgettable. She was the perfect average, but never perfectly average, beauty of the silver screen. For a girl who represented the small town on screen, the woman known as Muriel Teresa Wright was born in one of the biggest cities in the world, Harlem, in New York City, on October 27th of 1918. Her parents separated when she was young, and the little girl moved out of New York and into the suburbs of Maplewood, New Jersey. A return trip to New York in 1936 put the young Muriel on the path to stardom after she watched actress Helen Hayes perform in the Broadway show Victoria Regina. After seeing that grand dame trod the boards, Wright knew she wanted to be an actress, and she started auditioning for the school plays at her local high school. After graduating in 1938, she moved back to New York, dropping her given name of Muriel in favor of her middle name, forever being known as Teresa, that's Teresa, not Teresa, Wright. She made her Broadway debut with an understudy for Dorothy McGuire and then Martha Scott as the doomed character of Emily in Thornton Wilder's landmark drama, Our Town. We'll come back to Thornton later. When Scott left the production to star in the film adaptation, Teresa Wright stepped into the role, the first of many impossibly beautiful small-town girls she'd played throughout her career. The next year, she'd star as Mary Skinner in Life with Father, a role she performed for 2 years. It was during this show that producer Samuel Goldwyn would see her and be enchanted by her, quote, unaffected genuineness. He signed Wright to a 5-year contract with Goldwyn Studios, where she made her film debut as Alexandra Giddens, the daughter of Betty Davis's cruel Regina Giddens and Lillian Hellman's The Little Foxes. Unlike other actresses, Wright demanded specific clauses in her contract with Goldwyn that allowed her to avoid sitting for cheesecake photos or other choreographed publicity opportunities. Teresa Wright wanted to be known for her acting, first and foremost.
Well, I can't explain it, but you came here and Mother's so happy. And I'm glad that she named me after you and that she thinks we're both alike. I think we are, too. I know it. Oh, it would spoil things if you should give me anything.
You're a strange girl, Charlie. Why would it spoil things?
Because we're not just an uncle and a niece. It's something else. I know you. I know that you don't tell people a lot of things. I don't either. I have a feeling that inside you somewhere there's something nobody knows about.
Something nobody knows?
Something secret and wonderful. I'll find it out.
In 1941, after the success of her role in The Little Foxes, Wright received the first of 3 Oscar nominations in her career for the role of Alexandra, though she'd lose to Mary Astor in The Great Lie. But she barely had time to catch her breath as she was quickly placed in a pair of films that would cement her status as an A-list star. Mrs. Miniver, the story of a middle-class British family struggling to live life during World War II, saw Wright play Carol Belden, the sweet daughter-in-law to Greer Garson's title character. She followed that up playing the supportive wife of baseball player Lou Gehrig in The Pride of the Yankees. Both films gave Teresa Oscar nominations, but it was Mrs. Miniver that nabbed her the win. She remains one of just 9 people to be nominated twice in the same category during an Oscar ceremony, and is actually the only performer to have Academy Award nominations for her first 3 films. But she wasn't happy. She felt that her career kind of stagnated, and she went to a role far darker than her trio of breakout performances. In 1943, she starred in Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, where she plays the naive niece to a possible serial killer played by Joseph Cotten.
Who are you?
Charlie.
Oh, yeah, first I didn't know you. I thought you were sick.
Sick?
You aren't sick, are you? Look, Pop, here he is. Why, Uncle Charlie, you're not sick. That was the funniest thing.
Sick? Me sick? Well, Joe, how are you? Haven't changed a bit.
Hi, Charles. You're looking great.
Roger. Hello, Aunt. Bet you don't remember me.
I remember you, sort of. You look different.
Shadow of a Doubt was pitched to Alfred Hitchcock by the head of David Selznick's story department, a woman named Margaret McDonnell. Margaret told Hitch about an idea that her husband Gordon had for a story based on the life of notorious serial killer Early Leonard Nelson. Hitchcock was intrigued and sat down with the couple for lunch at the Brown Derby, commissioning Gordon to write an outline for the story that he called Uncle Charlie. Armed with the outline, Hitchcock sought out Our Town creator Thornton Wilder to write the script. Hitchcock was a fan of the small town as Wilder had envisioned it. The playwright was initially uninterested in writing the story, but an upcoming military tour and an ill sister compelled him to take the job. It said that he and Hitchcock would work in the mornings, leaving the afternoon for Wilder to write, quote, according to his fancy. Another author of small town nostalgia, Meet Me in St. Louis scribe Sally Benson, also collaborated on the script to inject humor. It's rumored that Wright herself was cast at Wilder's urging, having known the actress through her work as Dorothy McGuire's understudy in Our Town, and her effervescence shines through as young Charlie. For his part, Joseph Cotten was borrowed from Selznick to play the character, and unlike other Hitch productions, everything ran relatively smoothly. Shadow of a Doubt received universal acclaim upon release in 1943, becoming Hitchcock's favorite film, and it's remembered as one of the Master of Suspense's best works. For Teresa Wright, though, things became a bit stickier after she made it.
Your mother's been telling me about the Newtons being picked for All-American Suckers. What do you know about it?
Well, Charlie wasn't here when they came, but really, Charles, Mr. Graham told it, it wasn't like snooping at all. It was our duty as citizens. It's something the government wants.
Government?
Maybe not exactly, but it's for the public good. And when I told him about you and all the places you'd been, he was really interested.
Now, listen, Emmy, I'll have nothing to do with this. I'm just a visitor here, and my advice to you is to slam the door in his face.
Oh, well, I couldn't do that. But you don't have to meet him if you don't want to.
Well, I think it'd be kind of exciting. You could take your photograph and then we could have it for nothing.
Despite her trio of Oscar nominations and her win, Wright would always be at the mercy of a studio that wanted to control when she could spend time with her family. Teresa Wright took 2 years off, returning in 1946 with one of her best roles in William Wyler's legendary post-war drama, The Best Years of Our Lives. Her second child, a daughter, would be born in 1947, and her desire to take time off to be with her family and the frustration of the role she was offered continued to strain her relationship with Samuel Goldwyn. By 1948, the relationship was completely untenable, and Goldwyn publicly ripped up Wright's contract. He called the actress uncooperative, and if you know what that word means to Hollywood actresses, it's kind of a kiss of death. Wright was off the screen for another 2 years, returning in 1950 with the Marlon Brando star The Men. But now taking less money and working for a different studio, her projects lacked the same fire as her earlier works. Films like The Capture, The Steel Trap, and Track of the Cat were all box office failures, though Wright continued to be cited in reviews as the best thing in all of them. By the mid-50s, she jumped onto the burgeoning television bandwagon and nabbed an Emmy nomination in 1957 for her performance in a Playhouse 90 adaptation of The Miracle Worker. She'd secure another Emmy nod in 1960 for the Margaret Bourke White story, and she'd make one final film appearance in 1997 in the Matt Damon legal drama The Rainmaker. Teresa Wright passed away at the age of 86 in 2005. When we come back, Drea Clark and I look deeper at Shadow of a Doubt.
Husbands who've spent their lives making fortunes, working and working, and then they die and leave their money to their wives, their silly wives. And what do the wives do, these useless women? You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands. Drinking the money, eating the money, losing the money at bridge, playing all day and all night, smelling of money. proud of that jewelry, but of nothing else. Horrible. Faded, fat, greedy women.
But they're alive. They're human beings.
Are they?
Well, listeners, we are starting a new month, and a new centennial celebration kicks off as we look at the career of Teresa Wright. We decided there were a couple ways we could do this, maybe talk about her role in Mrs. Miniver, but then we realized that we had just done a war movie when we did Since You Went Away. Maybe we'd do Pride of the Yankees, but I'm not really big on baseball. So we went back to the old standby, which is Hitchcock. This podcast really just needs to be a subgenre of Hitchcock-related episodes. So we're talking about 1943's Shadow of a Doubt, and I'm here with one of my regular co-hosts, the wonderful Drea Clark. Drea, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing good. We are recording this with some nice, shiny new technology on your part.
Brand new. It is as new as this film is old. I find it a very appropriate juxtaposition.
We had some audio issues earlier, so hopefully everything sounds good, or at least it will once it goes through the handy-dandy editing process, but we're not going to let that stop us from discussing Alfred Hitchcock and Shadow of a Doubt. Drea, what is your background with this movie and Hitchcock before we discussed it for this episode?
Well, I was a Hitchcock fan growing up because my dad really liked to have me watch the classics, and the classics for him were basically Hitchcock and film noir. So it was a small, narrow window, but it was an appreciated one. So I remember watching this really young and not being into it at all because I couldn't relate to young Charlie. And then I watched it in a Hitchcock-specific course in university, and it was one of those things, once you have your eyes open to the storytelling and cinema language of just how visuals and dialogue and performances and all of the technical decisions build suspense and build a moment, it's one of those films that you appreciate more and more. So I haven't seen it for a few years, and it was really nice going back to it and just revisiting and taking it all in again.
What was your prior knowledge of Teresa Wright before talking about this episode?
Minimal. I mean, I had seen Mrs. Miniver, and I think that's it.
Yeah, my background with Teresa Wright is I know her more as an actor than I do for her films. And that is to say that I'd seen Mrs. Miniver, and I was very taken with her performance in that film. She's definitely one of those actresses that was very unpolished, very, I don't want to say basic, because that implies that there's nothing there, but she doesn't have the artifice of the Hollywood actress, the glamour girl. So I'd seen Mrs. Miniver, and I'd actually read a biography about her after that, and the name escapes me right now of what it is. It's something that's come out within the last 5 years, and it was a fantastic look at a woman who was not really invested in Hollywood and often got opportunities and was often suspended from those opportunities because she wanted to get married. She wanted to have children. She wanted to be a woman, and that didn't work with being a Hollywood star many times. And so it's only been recently that I've gone back and actually looked at her body of work. And even then, I still haven't seen some of the bigger films that she's done, stuff like The Little Foxes or Pride of the Yankees.
I was going to say, I have seen Pride of the Yankees, and how dare I forget to miss that.
This is the second Teresa Wright film that I'd seen. This is the second time I've seen this. So I had seen this, I think, last year for the first time ever. And, we'll get into it when we start breaking it down, but this was considered Hitchcock's favorite film because he liked bringing menace to a small town. But this isn't my favorite Hitchcock film.
Well, that's what I find. I think I mentioned to you how intriguing it is to me that he numerous times said that this was his favorite films out of the ones he directed, because I don't know if I know anyone where this is their favorite Hitchcock. And analyzing that, I mean, you could dig into for years. I do like you phrasing it as terrorizing a small town, because that is a very Hitchcockian love. He loves to dismantle the small towns in there. And that this particular one was crafted in part by Thornton Wilder, the king of small towns, makes it even more of a... I liked that part of it. But yeah, it being his own favorite is really interesting.
Yeah, I can't say this is my favorite. It does have a lot of the tropes that Hitchcock would end up exploring. The concept of, like, the perfect murder that comes through a lot. The duality, the young woman who is at the mercy of an older man and having to navigate that. I feel like this is a really great test case of stuff that he would build upon in other movies.
For sure.
I say that this isn't my favorite. That's not to say that I dislike it at all. But it does feel very intimate, you know? Well, it feels like a small play or something. Like most of his movies, I guess.
Of course. The other thing, too, is you forget how many movies he made, how wonderful all, if so many of them were, and that he was doing it over a couple decades. So thinking of this being in the sort of mid-40s and like 15 years before Psycho, I mean, the person who made Psycho also made this. They're almost another generation of filmmakers within one career.
Yeah, and that's the thing I think is really great about this movie, is that he's taking a lot of the things that were happening outside society, and he is British, so he's seeing the war from a totally different angle, and he's taking all of the elements that he already likes and enjoys and just puts them in one little hour and 40-minute movie about a young girl who thinks that her uncle is a murderer. And there's a lot of intrigue in there. I think that the best place to start is with the relationship between the Charlies. There's a lot of duality in this, and that happens with most Hitchcock films, whether it's the two murderers in Rope or Strangers on a Train, the use of mirrors, all of that. He loves that duality. But here, it comes through in a way that is both mental, they're almost psychic with each other. Charlie goes to put the telegram out to Uncle Charlie to bring him to town because she feels that her family needs some sort of miracle, and he's already coming, almost as if they're calling to each other. But then there's also the biological duality, which is that they share a lineage, you know, that they are uncle and niece, and so it leads to this really weirdly incestuous relationship.
Yes!
Was that just me being a creep?
No, that was not you being a creep. It's funny, when we talked about Since You Went Away,
yes,
I mentioned how much I appreciated the restraint they had, and that all of Joseph Cotton's scenes in that with the younger Jennifer Jones felt chaste to me. They felt respectful of their age difference, that he was very deferential. Whereas this, there were many times, and that's why I know it was an intentional element that was added. We know Joseph Cotton can have those scenes and not always have that creepiness. Whereas in this, there were several times when they were having discussions or he would touch her hair or something, and I was like, no, shut it down, no, I don't like it. And you get that creepy uncle feeling rather than, oh yeah, that's just a normal, oh yeah. It ratchets up the overall suspense when you have that kind of uncomfortable quasi-incestuous thread going through.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, I actually wrote in my notes, so I'm glad I'm not the only one that thought of Since You Went Away, because we, in that episode, in that movie, I brought up how it was a little creepy, because I think Jennifer Jones plays that role so childlike.
Right.
She's overwrought. She's very immature until the middle part of the movie. Here, Teresa Wright, we're never really clear what her age is, but I think alluding to the fact that she's over 18, but she's still an adult. She acts like an adult. And their relationship is treated as an adult entanglement. He buys her a ring. She's happy that the girls that are walking down the street with them are jealous. They think she has this new beau. They really sell it as a relationship. And I think it's something that had to be intentional a couple years ago, if anybody saw the film Stoker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's very much a continuation of Shadow of a Doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching this,
I was watching the interactions between Joseph Cotton and Teresa Wright, and I was like, I don't have a problem with this like I do since she went away. I think Hitchcock's actually, and Hitchcock is one of those. He is weirdly perverse in sexuality.
Yes.
And here, it's all really restrained, but there is some heat to it.
Well, and Hitchcock's perversion, his sexuality has so much to do with control, which, you know, knowing what we know about him as a director and what his leading ladies went through with him, it comes out loud and clear in these things. But the idea, like you're talking about, that this uncle would want to court jealousy from outsiders in his behaviors towards his niece, or that he has a strange territorialness when she does have a love interest that comes into play. And on one hand, it's because that person also represents threat towards him. But on the other hand, it's still unnecessarily tied to something that's outside of his criminal acts, that's more about his relationship, about his ownership over his niece, over this young woman in his life. And yeah, it's very intentional and squirm inducing, and it's consistent. And I do think, like you were saying, the dual poles of things, that there's something about Uncle Charlie, who is just this person rigidly trying to gain control over situations, and this young girl who's learning to control and learning to, like, own the power that's given to her. And I find that the most interesting duality in this film, but it is something that stands out from all of his films. And I wonder if it's one of the reasons that he liked it so much.
When you brought up the McDonald Carey character who plays Jack, the cop, the detective that comes to the town, this is set in Santa Rosa, California, and he kind of ingratiates himself with Charlie in order to get her to turn over her uncle. And their relationship is incredibly chaste. It's downright asexual. They don't even go on anything, I think, that passes for a date. She discovers in a very abrupt cut, like, 1 minute they're out doing something, and the next she's sitting down, she's like, you're a detective! And I'm like, wait, where's the middle to this conversation? It's just transitioned. But their relationship is incredibly asexual, and the movie ends with them united, but I'm never believing that's a relationship that's gonna last. They're more friendly, I think, than anything else. Whereas what makes the relationship between Charlie and Uncle Charlie, I'm gonna say it hot, and I hate to say that, but it is, is it's that concept of, like, she's known him her entire life. It's that weird, like, going back to that biological connection between them. And Hitchcock's really making you feel, like, horrible for even thinking, like, hey, maybe these two crazy kids can get together. And then you're like, oh, wait, no, that's her uncle.
Well, I certainly was never rooting for them in any way.
I'm sure there gross. Is a disgusting, yes. weird, like, yes. fan fiction-y there... world that roots
there,
for that.
There is a subsection of Reddit that really enjoys that thread. I was never rooting for them, but I do know what you mean. I was wondering if something would happen. But it's interesting because as much as the tangible threads of their strange, twisty relationship are very present and recognizable and believable, a lot of the characters in this and how they respond and their motivations, to me, are implausible in that kind of theatrical way that you alluded to earlier, that this has a very stage feel almost for something that still feels about this town and is cinematic. Because with McDonald Carey, for example, you never really see the growth of their relationship, and that's fine. A lot of movies mishandle love stories. But to me, it was to the point, I just kind of assumed for most of it, he was only flirting with her or saying anything so he could get information out of her. So when she started turning to him for support, and then when they kind of say, oh, we're together, it's going to continue, I was kind of flabbergasted, like, oh, wait, I thought one of you was getting played, but you're both sort of in this. And that kind of thing, to me, registered as unbelievable as the fact that her sweet parents, who raised this very bright and aware girl, are somehow both so clueless about the realities of the brother-in-law's character. And, you know, that the mother is the root of why young Charlie wants to work so hard to protect Uncle Charlie for her mother's sake rather than to save him. And it's that strange... And I didn't always believe that that's how it would go down in real life, but I was still immersed in this world, so I was fine with it for story purposes.
Yeah, you brought up the parents and the fact that one of the, I think, things that I'm really, maybe because I've seen other Hitchcock films before this, there's not a real sense of ambiguity with Uncle Charlie at a certain point, especially compared to something like maybe Suspicion, where the entire movie you're wondering whether Cary Grant's character is supposed to be evil or not. And we haven't talked about Suspicion, but if we ever get to it, I have so many problems with that movie. But you mentioned that there is suspense throughout, that you think that it's pretty evident that Uncle Charlie is guilty.
Immediately. I mean, from the minute we see him laying there and he's looking out for the people looking for him, even before I know that the people looking for him are cops, I'm like, oh, this guy's a bad guy. And then we see him fleeing town and in this suspicious manner where he's locked himself in a private cabin as a sickly person and his fake limp, his Kaiser Soze moment coming out of the train. Like, it's kind of amazing that there's, to me, no attempt to do the red herring of, ooh, maybe he is. That's not what this story is about. It's not trying to get the viewer to wonder if, oh, maybe she's crazy and he is okay. Or we kind of know from the word go that Uncle Charlie is a sketchy individual. And so it's seeing the depths of it, like when we reveal, oh, what he did. Oh, it's not just he robbed a lemonade stand. He's got some murder behind him. It's learning his criminal acts. But you always know he's a bad guy, and so you're always wondering, when will young Charlie figure it out, and how much risk will that put her at? So the piecemealing is a really interesting way to come into a mystery, because, you know, so often these stories start at a totally different point.
Well, I think the thing that separates this from other Hitchcock films is that there isn't a lot of grand moments. You know how you see certain movies where it's about a child trying to convince adults of something, and they've usually witnessed something, or there's a series of events of things that are obviously proof of this person's evil, and then the child goes to tell them, and for some reason the adult gets to kind of poo-poo it away. That doesn't happen here. We don't see Uncle Charlie murder anybody once he's in Santa Rosa. There's nothing on Charlie's end that would give her suspicion that he is bad. And really, I think some of the suspicion that she crafts is a bit silly. The newspaper. She, like, hones in on the newspaper in his pocket.
Oh, yeah.
So, backstory. I gotta give backstory on this. He's reading the newspaper. He notices that there's an article about him in the paper. And so, in order to get rid of it, he entices the youngest sister, Anne, to come watch him make a house out of the newspaper. And then everybody is immediately like, that's father's paper. How dare you? And like all three children, Anne, the little brother, and Charlie are like, oh my God, scandalous. The paper, wherever, whatever will we do? Father's gonna beat us because we let you rip up this paper. And so they're immediately suspicious. They're like, there was something in the paper you didn't want him to say. What is with this paper, you guys? I mean, is it the Holy Grail?
Yeah. Their response to the paper is exactly one of those moments I'm referring to. And I was like, yeah, that's not really how humans act or behave. But it's more, oh, are you giving us a big clue that we all need to know? And so, yes. So I'm like, okay, I'll just go with it. Nobody talks like that, and those kids wouldn't freak out like that, because to them, it's an adult, and so he can do what he wants, but what do you do?
Exactly, yeah. So some of the building of tension really does come from just very small seeds of doubt as opposed to a grander thing.
I believe you mean shadows of doubt.
Oh, I was trying to avoid the bingo of using a phrase that is actually the title.
True.
I did want to bring up how both Joseph Cotten and Teresa Wright kind of approach the dual Charlies. I know when we talked about Since You Went Away, I said Joseph Cotten, he's not really for me. He's still not really for me here, but there is this kind of smugness to him. He plays the role very nice and charming, but he's not ebullient like he was as Tony in Since You Went Away. Whereas Teresa Wright is very peppy, but she's not annoying. She's not Jennifer Jones just like falling over his feet and acting very melodramatic. Again, it's like watching two very natural people act naturally with each other.
Yes. I think, well, as you know, I will take Joseph Cotten in whatever flavor I can get him. So this one worked for me. But again, it was nice having that juxtaposition of Since You Went Away for this sort of uncle outside character, because the charm that he's putting forth in Shadow of a Doubt is a very different timbre. There's something about his performance that makes me appreciate him as an actor because it's much more calculated. I feel for someone that's in the position that he is in, who's trying, he's on the lam, he's trying to set up roots and live this sort of comfortable small town life of money that maybe he's always dreamed of, that he does not put on the charm in the way that you think a con man would. It's more, oh, he's probably a decent criminal, but it's not always on, if that makes sense. Like, he's not slick with it, which makes it a little more human feeling. It's a little messier, his being able to turn the charm on and off. But I think we had briefly talked about, there's something in this film that it's not always the way how people react, but both Teresa Wright and Joseph Cotten have performance elements, especially in longer takes, where they will do these ginormous tonal shifts of an emotional reading in a scene. So that, especially at the beginning, she would have long scenes where she was very dour and then pep up just sort of within a thing. And you're like, I've never seen anybody's emotions do a 180 like that in one shot, but it fits within this world. And he has this one, it's a menacing shot where he's talking about the uselessness of wheezing widows and how they're just out there taking up air, basically. And it's so dark and horrifying, and you would never say it at a family dinner table. And at the end of it, he kind of catches himself and is like, all right, so what's now? And this is, again, in another huge 180. And I liked that if only one of them had made that choice as an actor, I would question it, if I wondered where that was coming from. But because they both are, with that duality, there's something of, oh, that is in this world. That's part of the language that's being set in this film.
Yeah, I mean, compared to Tony, who he's a lady killer in the sense that he's got a girl in every port, and yeah, you're definitely believing that he's a guy that is probably going to snake your woman, but he's not going to murder her. He just doesn't seem to have it in him. Here, though, and I think it's what's great that this and Since You Went Away are only a year apart, is that his performance is not showy. He's not Patrick Bateman,
yeah,
where it's just like mugging and all of that. It's more subtle. You brought up the speech when he's talking about the widows and how he's a total misogynist. But then he's got this ability to be what everybody wants him to be in the house. You know, he's the fun playmate for the younger kids. He's the guy that Charlie would want to find in another man who is not related to her. To his sister, he's the dutiful little brother. He conforms to each person. And I think if you look at who else was considered for this role, Alfred Hitchcock wanted William Powell, but he couldn't get him loaned out from MGM. And he also thought about Cary Grant. Joseph Cotten was kind of like a third choice. And I can't see either one of those two actors being this character. Could you?
I feel like Cary would be, and I think he has terrific range and I love him as an actor, but no, you're right. I don't think he could have that correct level of slime and the duplicity of character. I feel like he's more of a straightforward. And he also seems, in a strange way, too worldly for this world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Cary Grant had 2 years before this done Suspicion, which was a movie based on who you read, and there were so many different stories. Either he couldn't be the villain because of his persona, or he didn't want to, or Hitchcock didn't want him to, or they did and the studio didn't want it. Regardless, there was a lot of different thoughts about whether he could convincingly play a villain. And so I feel like if Cary Grant had been in this, then we would have had to change the end. And also, yeah, he's got that whole mid-Atlantic, refined, polished quality. You know, you have to believe that Uncle Charlie is like living hand to mouth. If he wasn't murdering women, he'd be the guy who's struggling. Cary Grant doesn't look like he's struggling, ever. Even when he plays a character.
Right. Well, and I think the difference is, we need to think that Uncle Charlie is originally from a place like this, as, you know, that's where his sister ended up, that's where he has his roots, and would be coming back to it from a city. Whereas Cary Grant, even when he was down on his luck in films, never seemed it. Yeah, I agree. And I think the ending would be tricky too. And William Powell would be too sexy. It really just would.
And William Powell in the 40s was not William Powell True. In the 30s. This isn't.
But it's still after my man Godfrey. I mean, it's.
Right, right. And I think the same problem you have with Cary Grant, you have with William Powell. There's too much of a refinement to him.
Yeah, definitely.
This is a guy that you feel like, she says, I would think that he wouldn't be happy in this world. He thought everybody was horrible. And I don't get that from Cary Grant or William Powell, that they would have such a bleak outlook on the world. Joseph Cotten, I could see that. I did want to bring up that this movie tries to go a little psychological, not in a way that, like, Spellbound is very psychological, trying to find a pinpoint what makes evil. And Hitchcock was very fascinated by this. This movie dabbles in that a little bit, alluding to the fact that as a child, Uncle Charlie suffered a head injury, and that might be why he's evil, which I'm like, I think we disprove that relatively early on, like that head injuries don't make you a mass murderer or a murderer at all. But it did lead me to find out that this character is actually based on a real person.
In Shadow of a Doubt.
Yes, yeah, in Shadow of a Doubt, Uncle Charlie was quote-unquote inspired by a real person named Early Leonard Nelson, a.k.a. the Gorilla Man.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. He was also known as the Gorilla Killer and the Dirk Strangler, which I am so surprised nobody has made a movie about that. But he's supposedly considered the first American serial sex murderer of the 20th century. And go to his Wikipedia page. It's horrible. But if you're a true crime person, you're gonna, like, eat this up. Supposedly he was into necrophilia and did horrible, horrible things. Had this whole, like, Pentecostal upbringing and was really weird as a child and suffered head injuries in a bicycle accident and committed all sorts of, like, horrific crimes before moving to Canada and committing crimes there, and then was executed at the age of 30. So, again, very weird life, but he was the real inspiration for Uncle Charlie. And I'm just thinking, Uncle Charlie just killed some women, but now I'm wondering if he did worse and we just aren't told that.
Well, like I said, that wouldn't surprise me, because when they first reveal about the Merry Widow killer.
Yeah, the Merry Widow murderer is what he's referred to as.
That when we hear that it's murder, it's not just robbery, it's not just whatever, that there's this thing of, oh, that each revelation is darker and worse, and so that this could just keep going. I mean, yeah, it does have this thing, and there is really something soulless about his performance that is not just the con man that's out for money, the whatever, but his casualness of recurring threats to his niece under his sister's roof. Do you know what I mean? That there's something about that. It's not just that kind of malicious, the villain that wants to get away with things or wants to. There's a soullessness to this character.
Well, and every one of Hitchcock's villains, I mean, as he would get more involved in his filming from the 50s, 60s, up until Frenzy, sexual violence plays a very heavy hand in his work. And I think it starts here with the whole concept of these parents have two small children as well as a teenage young adult woman living under their roof, and he's just slowly getting into their minds. And what does that mean? I mean, you have to think it's coding about something even more nefarious. And there's actually a ton of stuff written about vampires and Uncle Charlie. Yeah. Supposedly there are several stories about Dracula in references to vampires. Some of them are a little thin, but according to IMDb, Uncle Charlie comes from Pennsylvania, Transylvania. Charlie uses the line that the same blood runs through our veins. That's from Dracula, when Dracula says that to Mina when he and Van Helsing have this kind of battle of wills to prove he has power over her. The telepathic communication,
right?
Much like Mina and Dracula. Uncle Charlie is, spoiler alert, killed on the train returning east, much like Dracula is returning east when he dies. So there's a ton of stuff. The opening of the movie, Uncle Charlie's lying on the bed with his arms folded.
Yes.
Yeah. So I didn't know any of this. Okay. And
that is fascinating.
Yeah. I'm so interested.
I didn't think of any of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. All of those elements completely check out in terms of being in this. Yeah.
And I think all of that leads to something. Just the creation of vampires, this foreign other. Uncle Charlie is a foreign other in the sense that he's from the U.S. and he's from that type of small town, but he's not a resident of Santa Rosa. People don't know him. He is this invader. And I think it's worth segueing and talking about the war, because by 43, we were, just like when we talked about Since You Went Away, we were mired in the war. The war had been going on for so long, it was just something we were used to. But I think what Hitchcock is alluding to would become far stronger in the next decade with UAC, which is that the concept of ingrained, not terrorism, but just this concept of, like, the people you think you know. He's American. He's got an American accent. There's nothing controversial about him. But you don't know him. We don't know what he's really doing. And I think that he really represents, we saw within the 80s with the Russians, there's American sleeper agents who are really Russian spies infiltrating. And I want to say that in the 40s with the Nazis, there was this concept of American-esque Nazi infiltrators, you know, that fear. And I think that he really plays into that, that idea that somebody can become radicalized, whether through a head injury or something else, but they just become this completely different person.
Oh, of course. Well, I think that there's something larger about, I really like the idea of this tying into the war, because I hadn't thought about that perspective. But there's something to me that comes up in this that I see sort of throughout American cinema, which is that small towns, and not just American cinema, but kind of the American general ethos, but that small towns are the real America, and that's where real Americans live, and they live real, honest lives, and that people in the cities, which are typically peopled with more othered, those are where threat comes from. And that there's these safe havens of small towns, and that the only badness is coming to them from the outside, from the cities, and then everything that the cities imply, which is either the foreignness that gets into the cities. And, you know, this is a super white town, so I, you know, that this would cast into all of that. But yeah, there's something that continues to this day of that real America is these small pockets, which is always funny when you think of how most of America actually lives in the cities. But it's an interesting cinema choice in terms of giving another kind of other, and villain making, even more than a blow to the head, is his time in the cities and exacerbated by this wartime setting.
Yeah, and I think it's important that he is a murderer, but he's murdered outside, in Philadelphia. He comes to this small town, and really what he's spreading is far more amorphous. Cynicism, pessimism, misogyny. He gaslights Charlie. He tells the father that his job's not good enough. He makes the mom a bit rude and entitled, you know, and they're kind of sniping at each other. That's what he's bringing. He's this kind of virus who's spreading just the stuff that supposedly small towns were isolated from. And I think that that's really telling, the concept that small towns were fortunate to isolate themselves from the war. By extension, issues with racism and issues with feminism and growing poverty, stuff like that. The concept of a small town is that you don't deal with that stuff. You move away from that, so you get away from the crime and the filth and all of that. But that's what Uncle Charlie brings, which is saying that that can't be kept out.
Exactly. Well, looking at it from the end, I'm interested in what you think of the choice of the ending and young Charlie's choice throughout to, in that small town way, and like you said, that the isolation would keep an accountability from coming in, because even the police sort of go along with her. Instead of making a move or making whatever, her priority is keeping her mother in the dark and keeping their family clean and not touched by this, rather than finding accountability or closure for the families that he had killed people in. And that's sort of never in question is a great showcase of how this small town perspective has permeated everything about young Charlie, that it's never questioned. Even the cops, they want some of it, but their whole thing is absurd. The idea that this young girl would be kind of calling the shots for them in a certain way, and that who knows what jurisdiction they're supposed to be a part of, that they ended up there. But I did puzzle over that her thinking from the beginning was much more about protecting her own family than getting any kind of justice.
I mean, they're the typical American family, right? They're the ones selected by the detectives for the photos. Supposedly, the cover that the detectives have is that they're taking photos of this all-American family. And that's really what Charlie wants to protect, their reputation. Because if you think about it, in a small town, if one person in a family is perceived to be a murderer, perceived to be damaged, especially in the time where the concept of evil is still being tied to genetics, it must be the family that's rotten. The whole family must be this way. So it is, I think, a sign of the times that Charlie's whole thing is, you know, not about returning him to a court of law or authorities. It's protecting the sanctity of the home in America, and her mother specifically. She treats her mother like she's some poor child who's not gonna be able to understand that her brother is a murderer, because again, it goes back to the fact that the parents were raised in the 1800s, which Charlie considers this magic time. It's almost like watching Midnight in Paris again, the whole concept of like each generation thinks the subsequent generation was the best. Mm-hmm. But it goes back there's a lot of superstition in this movie too. The dad tells Uncle Charlie not to throw the hat on the bed because it signals trouble. And it's not just trouble for Charlie herself, but it's trouble for Uncle Charlie because it brings the detectives. And by extension, America, this whole concept of like, if we go against the old ways, we're gonna bring trouble in on ourselves.
Interesting.
We'll save the end for the end, because I do have one big issue that ties into what you were bringing up with the whole concept of, like, never getting justice. I did want to bring up Teresa Wright, because I don't think we've really looked at her as a performer in this. She had done some big performances, but this is her movie. I mean, she holds this on her shoulders. And you brought up that she's this really bold character who's not a victim.
Yeah, I think that there's something about having a girl, especially in 1943, having a female lead that's not entirely a romantic lead, but a more independent character. She's not just not following in the domestic footsteps of her mother, but she's kind of positions herself above her mother in terms of strength or personal power in this wanting to protect her. And she sets things in motion. She's living this rich life. And I love that. I think you mentioned earlier that Teresa Wright has a kind of refreshing, especially for this time, an unmannered performance that still managed to have the stylistic flourishes that Hitchcock brings out in people and is definitely in this, in the sort of long shots I was talking about. But she's so comfortable in every moment on screen, and she has to, because there are pretty much everything that's set into place is because she's pushing things in place. And you can tell a timid performer a mile away, and this is someone who's in there and owning the space and keeping things moving. And I loved the boldness of Charlie, that she wants to bring him in, she wants to shake things up, she wants her world to be bigger and different. And then when it is, instead of retreating or turning to her parents to fix it, she confronts that as head on as she does her boredom at the beginning.
Yeah, she's a classy young woman, but she's never a damsel. And I think what I love is that Uncle Charlie brings cynicism, but what it brings to her is this opening of the eyes, almost, that she's able to see past what other people see about him. So, like, when she almost dies in the garage, and they pull her out, and he looks down at her, and he wants to help her, and she just says, "Go away."
Yes!
And it really hurts him more than I think anything else, because for once, she's not pleased to see him. She's not happy. She's not peppy. She's a realist. She's a pragmatist. And it's worth bringing up that Hitch wanted this to either go to Joan Fontaine or Olivia de Havilland.
Oh!
I don't think you could have gotten the guile, the naturalness from two very highly polished actresses by that point.
And I think they also wouldn't have the same... You mentioned her kind of nebulous age. I thought that that was such an intentional thing, that first you assume she must be kind of young. She lives at home, and her brother and sister are so young that, oh, there wouldn't be that much of a gap. But she's also assured enough and feminine enough that the sexuality and the flirtation with MacDonald Carey, those things also fit. Olivia de Havilland, I don't know if I would have that kind of ambiguous age from her. She would either seem like a woman in the house or not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the lover's angle, I think, would have been far more pronounced. You brought up my big plot hole with this movie, which is, when did these parents have these children?
Oh, yeah. No, the parents are like 70 years old. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Her parents are about as old as the parents, if anybody's seen A Date with Judy. Wallace Beery and the mom and that, having Jane Powell and, like, a little boy. And you're like, when did these parents have these children, when they were 70?
Yeah.
I'm not understanding. But there are other characters in this movie, and we'll touch on them very briefly.
Good, because my two favorite characters have not yet been
discussed. Which are?
Well, obviously, you know me at this point, and you know that my number one favorite character in this entire film was the waitress in the coffee shop, or in the bar, when the two Charlies have this really tense showdown in a booth. And she is so incredible and so strange and such a perfect weird character moment. She's so committed to it.
We talked about Shirley Temple's friend in Since She Went Away, who didn't speak. And then in this movie, we have the waitress who shows up, and she looks to be about maybe 17, but she acts like she's 45 and led, like, a hard life. And,
like, she's outlived two husbands. She's put her kids through it. No, that is the Drea Clark special, is that kind of character, and that girl was perfection.
She acts like a 45-year-old diner waitress.
Yes.
And she's talking about how, "I wouldn't have thought to see you here. I work here. I got fired from my other job." And then, you know, Teresa Wright puts the ring on the table, and she's like, "I've always wanted a ring like that."
It's amazing. And she has this monotone, but it's a good performance. It's almost that speech pattern of someone who doesn't know how to deliver lines, except for it's elevated just enough. You're like, oh no, that's a character. And then the second one, again, knowing me, Hume Cronin and the weirdo neighbor who comes by,
in his film debut, too.
That I know. I didn't, for a minute, I didn't recognize him. And I was like, is that? It's gotta be. No one else has that profile. And it was. And I loved... It was something that added to the overall texture of the suspense and the moments of absurdity were his character, who's the neighbor and the friend of the father, and they would get into several of these ongoing discussions of, again, talk about Hitchcock, Strangers on a Train, of how you would murder someone to get away with it, that they were very matter-of-fact about it. It was this great just gallows humor that I enjoyed, and that he also foiled one of Uncle Charlie's plans, the sort of poisoning in the car, or the exhaust of the car, to poison young Charlie and saved her inadvertently. But I just think he's great and was such a great quirky little inclusion that both allowed that kind of language to be happening and to be talking about murder on a whole other level, or talking about threat on a whole other level. But it also is a nice way of building out this world, of giving them neighbors, of giving them the people to interact with and kind of mix it up.
Yeah, Hume Cronyn is Herbie. That's the sweetest, happy murderer, I think, in the world. Like, he shows up to their dinner while they're eating dinner, and A, he's very, very concerned about the fact that they're eating dinner earlier, but he's also like, I was out picking mushrooms. I thought that I could totally kill you with these. And again, just the most pleasant murderer you could ever find. I thought that was very, very funny. But yeah, they really pepper out this world in an Our Town kind of way. And Patricia Collins, who I just watched in another movie from 1943, she was in Tender Comrade, which I just watched with Ginger Rogers, and she gets kind of short shrift in that movie, and she's got a really great plot. Here, I think she gets equally short shrift as the mom, who is, again, considered this porcelain doll who can't have anything bad happen to her, and she's very mired in the past and remembering things from when her and Uncle Charlie were very little. It's just kind of keeping that flame alive. Before we talk about the end, we should touch on the fact this was a box office failure upon release, which is very disappointing, but not surprising for some of Hitchcock's films, at least the more successful ones. I think of this in, like, Rope. But it was nominated for an Academy Award. It was nominated for Best Writing Original Story by Gordon McDonnell, and did not win. If anybody would like to know who the winner was, the winner that year was The Human Comedy.
Huh. For original story?
Yeah. The More the Merrier, Shadow of a Doubt, Action in the North Atlantic, and Destination Tokyo were nominated, but The Human Comedy
That's one. The Mickey Rooney movie, right? I was I must be thinking of the wrong movie, because I can only think of the Mickey Rooney film. Huh, all right.
There's that.
Well, there you go.
Exactly, we have nothing to say about that.
Well, we never can.
Yeah. But Shadow of a Doubt and The More the Merrier were not worth winning. Okay, you know what? I can't with the Academy right now. It's just making all sorts of bad decisions, even today. So we did bring up the ending. So Uncle Charlie dies, and the movie ends with his funeral. And the thing that I was really taken by, we know that the code said that bad guys have to be punished, but the secret really dies with him. And I mean, young Charlie knows, and McDonald Carey's character knows, but there's never any justice. And in fact, Charlie kind of plays this as a mercy killing. He wouldn't have been happy in this town. He hated the world. And Hitch wanted to focus on the concept of we always destroy the thing that we love. But I don't know if that necessarily works for me nowadays. I'm just like, I wanted something. I wanted everyone to know that he was just, like, a horrible human being. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have expected that.
No, I'm with you. Like I said, it was kind of niggling at me the whole time that it's never once a concern, or even brought forth by the two police characters, that justice needs to be served, that and that they're also complicit in wrapping it up at the end. I mean, obviously, we've seen other films where everyone sort of decides to take the secret with them. That's your sort of Murder on the Orient Express. But the idea of, in this instance, it doesn't sit right. And it is funny because I read her justifications for he wouldn't have been happy made sense to me more on the level of a young woman who has killed a human being that she was related to and needs to justify that in her brain so she doesn't go crazy. So that, I was like, I can see why Charlie, also, she can't talk to her parents about it. Like, I hope she stays with McDonald Carey, or he's going to leave and she's going to live her whole life with this enormous secret, both of Uncle Charlie's acts and her own. So I really do hope those crazy kids make it work.
Exactly, I'm just like, okay. It's a little bit of a muted expectation that when all is said and done. It just kind of ends. There's no grand bombast. There's no third act cinematography extravaganza like other Hitchcock films. So it's unique. It's a unique ending.
I think the uniqueness of the ending is the perfect capper to a prime whodunit where we always knew who did it. I think it's that same uniqueness of the general storyline.
Listeners, let me know your thoughts on To Raise a Right, Alfred Hitchcock, Shadow of a Doubt, all of that. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and we'll read them on the next episode. Drea, where can fans find and get in touch with you before we see you again soon?
I am on Twitter at @TheDreaClark, and that's probably the best. I'm posting a lot right now about the LA Film Festival, and then random other film observations the rest of the time.
And we will have Drea back on in the next couple of weeks to do other episodes. So it's fun alternating, and I promise we won't get another Joseph Cotten film for you next time. Or maybe we should.
My loss. Keep it going. I'll only talk about Joseph Cotten.
Just to throw out a brief audio note, I greatly apologize for the audio issues. We're still working out the kinks of having Drea record using Skype. So hopefully it was not too harsh on your ears. But that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business, this very delayed episode of Ticklish Business. You can always listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly with questions, comments, suggestions for future movies at ticklishbiz.com. That's biz@gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at @ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. Right now, patrons can get access to a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast it is. If you become a patron right now, you can listen to episodes of my two new supplementary shows. Co-host William Bibbiani and I look at how Hollywood talks about itself in cinema with the show Based on a True Podcast. There's an episode out right now where we talk about the George Reeves murder and the biopic Hollywoodland. We're gearing up to record our Halloween episode looking at the film Shadow of a Vampire about the making of Nosferatu. You can also hear Adam Kautzer and I talk about the 1956 1985 and 2018 versions of The Bad Seed on our other show, Doubled Features, which looks at the features Hollywood films again and again. You can also check out all my past content that's on there, including my interviews with author Alan K. Rohde and TCM tour guide Sarah Louise Lilly. If you're interested in becoming a patron or just learning more, head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to hear more about the stars in my centennial celebration, and you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club TCM Backlot, then you can read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted here as I discuss films and information that you won't hear on the show. But next time, Dre and I might actually be back. I'm not really sure how scheduling is going to go, so I'm not going to release that episode just yet in terms of telling you what it is. So I'll just go off of the schedule in terms of recording. So you're going to hear Samantha Ellis and I as we celebrate Halloween by going into the Twilight Zone. That's right. We're going to be talking about our top three favorite episodes of the Rod Serling classic, as well as the 85. Do not quote me on that, and I don't have access to checking right now. But we're going to be looking at the film version as well. So it should be a very, very spooky episode. And we'll hear you next time.